Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Dr. Harry March is one of a handful of people in history is described as the father of professional football. Having a title like that definitely places him in a very important person category in football history. The good doctor's great-grandson, historian Alan March, visits the Pigpen to provide the bio on this integral man of professional football's development in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. And today we have a very exciting episode to talk about a very important person in pro football history, in football history for that matter. And we have his great-grandson, Alan March, here to describe Dr. Harry March. And I'm going to bring Alan in right now. Alan March, welcome to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Harry.
What you were telling me in our emails going back and forth prior to this discussion, and what you just told me before we hit the record button, is extraordinary. And I can't wait to get into the life of Dr. Harry March. So if you could, maybe just give us a brief thumbnail sketch of who Harry March was, and then we'll go into a little bit more detail in his history.
Okay. Growing up, I knew Harry as Hottie. That was the name that his grandson, my father, gave him when he couldn't pronounce Harry correctly. So sometimes if you hear me say Hottie instead of Harry, it's because I'm slipping into the family vernacular. But Dr. Harry March of Canton, Ohio, he led a fascinating life with six careers. He was a physician, a journalist, and author. He was the county coroner in Stark County, Northeast Ohio, a politician, a soldier. And most importantly, what he's most widely known, he was a sportsman. He was an athlete himself, but even more importantly than that, he was an organizer of sports. 1925, he helped organize the New York Giants. Shortly after that, he became a very active member of the NFL's executive committee, and he served in that capacity for years. 1934, he wrote the first history of professional football. The book is called Pro Football, Its Ups and Downs. And the next year, he began creating a rival league to the NFL, the American Professional Football League. That lasted about a year. Harry's an amazing guy. He packed so much into his 64 years. I don't know how he did it. I think he might have been ADD or something.
Or maybe he cloned himself or something. That sounds like a lot to do for one lifetime. So this is a very interesting fella for sure.
Yeah, he was the sixth child of six. His father was a Civil War veteran, and he was the youngest of six kids. His oldest sister, Annie, was 19 years older, and very little is known about her. She actually ended up dying at age 72 in the Massillon State Hospital of senility. Not too sure what happened with her. She may have been developmentally disabled. But all his other siblings, Edgar March became a prominent physician in Canton, Ohio. Douglas, known as D.W. March, became a prominent attorney in Ohio, eventually went to the Dakota Territories and helped form North and South Dakota. His sister, Julia, became a medical doctor in 1888 when it was an unheard thing for women to do. His brother, Harder, his closest in age sibling, became a dentist and for 20 years ran a dental clinic in Canton's schools. He was part of a family of high achieving people. And here he was, the youngest kid, and he had wiry red hair. He had to do something to stand out. What he did was everything. Graduated high school at the age of 14 in 1890 and went to prep school at Mount Union College, now University of Mount Union in Alliance, Ohio. And after a couple years there doing prep school, he actually took a collegiate course in basically pre-med, sciences, biology, graduated 1895. His first job right out of college was as a journalist, and he covered all kinds of stories. A year after that, the big story, though, was William McKinley's presidential campaign. Well, he knew McKinley because McKinley was a father of his friend, and he covered McKinley's campaign, and when McKinley rode the inaugural train to Washington, D.C., Harry went with him. And McKinley said to Harry, "Journalists are lounge lizards," which inspired Harry to go to medical school. So he enrolled in medical school in Columbian University Medical School in Washington, D.C. He actually roomed with his father for a while because his father, Henry, had gotten a job as a clerk in the Treasury Department. Basically, he was helping process Civil War veterans' pensions. McKinley helped him get that job. So Harry, while he's in Washington, he got a part-time job as a journalist, but specifically as a theater critic. This becomes very important later on in his career. So he's writing theatrical reviews. He becomes the president of his medical school. 1901, he graduates, and he's the toastmaster of the graduation ceremony held in the National Theater. Travels back to Canton, starts his own practice, and marries Edith Freeze. Now, she is the daughter of a prominent family. Her father was a judge. Her grandfather was a judge. And when her grandfather was an attorney, he hired William McKinley for in McKinley's first job as an attorney. That all these people in Canton are connected. So 1901, Harry gets married in a double wedding in his in-law's living room. And shortly after that, he starts getting politically connected. He gets onto the local school board, and then he decides he's going to get involved with football. When he went to Mount Union College, he played football on that school's first team. He was a fullback in 1893. Now, there had been club teams before, but it was the first sanctioned team for Mount Union. Now Mount Union is just a powerhouse. I think it's a Division II team. I looked at their record just this week. They won their first game 63-0. They won their second game 63-0. I think they've got four shutouts just this year. Powerhouse team.
Wow.
1894, Harry's senior year, he's still with the team. And there's a team photo of him that appears in a history of the Mount Union, but nobody's named, but Harry stands out. He's not wearing a uniform. He's wearing a suit. He worked as the referee or manager. As far as I know, he never again played football, but he appears in photos with football teams for the rest of his life. So he's got a couple years experience in college football. When he graduates medical school, goes back to Canton, starts getting involved with the schools, he decides he's going to coach the Canton High School football team. His nephew, Thorold, what a name, Thorold March, is on the football team. So he's coaching, and there's a couple other coaches there, and he coaches them for a couple of years. One of his assistant coaches or co-coaches is the county coroner, Dr. Schultz. Schultz resigns as coroner, promotes Harry to get the position. The Republicans put Harry in the job. And so Harry's now the county coroner. So he's a physician, he's on the school board, and he's coaching the team, and now he's a coroner. He drops out of coaching, but right about that time, the Canton Athletic Club is building its own football team to take on the rival Massillon Tigers. Canton and Massillon have long been rivals for more than a century, and it's really coming to its genesis right then, 1904, 1905, and Harry is there. Now, when the Canton Athletic Club was formed and they were actually selling shares to stockholders, I would have thought that here's Harry, he's part of a prominent family in town, he's a mover and shaker. I did not find his name anywhere as any of the shareholders. But there is a team photo with him, once again, with the 1906 Canton Bulldogs. And it's a big, gorgeous panoramic photo. And there's Harry kneeling in front. He's always kneeling in front with the team. He was the team physician. And there are stories about him attending all the football games for the Bulldogs and sometimes for the Tigers. And he doesn't care who the team members are. If somebody's hurt on the field, he'll be out there and he'll be helping them. After the 1906 Canton betting scandal, and I don't know if you've ever had that covered.
Yeah, we have a little bit. We've had a gentleman whose great-grandfather played for Massillon, so we talked about it quite a bit.
Oh, Greg Fisseri.
Yeah, Greg Fisseri.
Greg Fisseri. Yes. Yeah. Oh, and the story in the book about his great-grandfather's coming out, that's a fantastic story.
It sure is.
There was a betting scandal, and it looked like some guys from Akron were trying to get the Bulldogs to throw the game, and it basically killed football in Canton for pro football anyway for about the next 5 or 6 years. So there wasn't a Kent football team for Harry to do anything with. Right about that time, he started a theatrical troupe called the American Stock Company. And it was a musical theater troupe. And what he was doing, he was using his experience as a theatrical critic, thinking, I can put on just as good a shows as anybody else. So he starts the American Stock Company. Eventually, he runs as many as 9 different musical theater troupes. He's a theatrical impresario. 1916, he starts his final one, and they're called March's Musical Merrymakers. He loved alliteration. A couple of his other troupes had been spinoffs where he got these ingenues, these ladies who are great stars in themselves, and he gave them their own companies. But he was always managing them, and part of that was finding the right talent, promoting them within his organization, building the logistics, getting the train schedules, contacting the theaters and making sure that there's openings there. And these are skills he ends up using later on when he becomes involved with the professional football. When he was appointed as Canton coroner, he finally got elected on his own in 1905. By nature, he had to be a political animal. Got very involved with the Republican Party. By 1912, he was the chairman of the Stark County Republican Party. Harry politically was a progressive, so he supported Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt had been out for a couple of years. His protege, Ohioan, William Howard Taft, was running for re-election. Harry, rather than promoting the incumbent, was promoting Teddy Roosevelt. He attends the National Convention in Chicago as a Roosevelt delegate, not supporting his fellow Ohioan. When the Republican Convention nominated Taft for a second term, Harry walked out with hundreds of other progressives. They formed a new political party. It was called the Progressive Party, but everybody called it the Bull Moose Party. Harry was there. He was part of that. When Roosevelt came to Northeast Ohio, Harry was there, and he escorted Teddy Roosevelt around as he campaigned for votes. Roosevelt's candidacy split the Republican votes. Woodrow Wilson got elected. Within a year, Harry is still politically connected, but the Progressive Party, Canton, wants him to run for mayor. Harry said, okay. 24 hours later, Harry withdraws without telling anybody in the Progressive Party. When the progressives found out, there was an outrage. They said he was a traitor. It was treason. And Harry said it was nothing of the sort. He says, I just had to take care of my theatrical business. Well, by the end of 1913, Harry was not only out of politics, he moved out of Canton. He moved to New York, Times Square, took his wife and his young son. He had an office overlooking Times Square. He's right in the heart of the theatrical business. His wife, my great-grandmother, lasted there 1 year. She went home to Canton, never to return. Harry's son, Ken, who by 1914 was about 13 years old, stayed out of school and toured with Harry's troupe for a year, appearing on stage as a young actor. Eventually, he went back home too, and he ended up graduating from Canton High School. So Harry is by himself from about 1915 in New York City. His family's in Canton. It's 1916, he starts March's Musical Merrymakers, and in about a year, he's finally making a profit, but he's losing his staff. They're enlisting. Some of the girls are going to become nurses. 1917, the railroads are nationalized by the U.S. government so they can move troops and material across the country. Harry decides to close down March's Musical Merrymakers. 42 years old, he was still a physician nominally, but he was really a theatrical impresario. Newspapers praised him, saying all honor to Dr. March and the Merrymakers for closing down shop and going to serve the country. He got a commission in the medical corps from Senator Attlee Pomeran, who had been a prominent Democrat in Canton. And age 42, Harry enlisted. Did not go overseas, spent about 3.5 months in northern Georgia, Camp Greenleaf. Well, they had a lot of football games there, and sports were used to help develop and keep soldiers busy. And he was there, witnessed that. He liked being a soldier. When he was mustered out in December of 1918, he decided he wanted to continue in the service, and he enlists in the National Guard. However, it was the New York National Guard as a medical officer. And he stays with the National Guard through 1929. 1922, Senator Attlee Pomeran, who helped Harry get a commission in the Army, also helps Harry's son, Ken, to become a cadet in West Point. Harry's at Times Square, and his son is just 50 miles north at West Point, and they end up visiting. Harry's continuing to get his name in the newspapers, writing letters to the editor about things. He's attending football games. He's living in an apartment building near Broadway. And he's talking to his mailman. Harry talks to everybody, especially journalists. And the mailman says, you know, he would like to go see some college football games. And he's saying that because he's handing Harry a letter. In that letter were tickets to an upcoming Army game. His son, as a West Point cadet, could get those tickets. So Harry was getting those tickets. And he's talking about that to the mailman. Mailman says, I would love to get tickets, but I don't have any connections to college. I'm not a college man, but I want to go see the games. Besides, I work on Saturdays. Tickets are expensive anyway. What's a working guy to do? Harry thinks back to his days when he was in Canton. He remembers the Canton Bulldogs. He remembers when he was on the road with his theatrical troops. He stopped in and watched football games. He's watching baseball games. He's making commentary, getting his names in the papers. He's talking to team managers. He knows the talent that's out there. Harry's thinking, we can bring pro football to New York City. One of the guys Harry knew that he got to meet when he was traveling around Ohio and seeing these football games was a guy named Joe Carr. Joe Carr had been the manager of the Columbus Panhandles, a pro football team, and they were named for the Panhandle Division of, I think, the Pennsylvania Railroad. And they were a pretty tough bunch of guys. I think six of them were the Nesser brothers, and they were all literally boilermakers, and they had to have rock hard hands, and they were a tough team. Harry got to know Joe, a couple of Ohio guys. In about 1924, Harry thinks we can get a pro team in New York. Well, Joe Carr, by 1921, had become president of the American Professional Football Association. Carr becomes president, replacing Jim Thorpe, who had not done a very good job. Great name, great athlete, not a good administrator. Carr knew business. One of the first things that was done with Carr as president, they renamed the organization as the National Football League. Carr understands that for the league to truly become a national league, it needs to succeed in the big cities. Now, Chicago, it's got two football teams. It had the Bears and the Cardinals, but really the Big Apple was the place. He knew Harry. Harry knew football, and Harry says, give me a franchise. I'll find an angel. So Carr says, okay, and Harry starts looking. One of the first people he talked to was Tex Rickard. Now, Tex Rickard was huge in sports. He was a sports promoter. He recently had owned the purchased the Madison Square Gardens. He was a fight promoter mostly. He was known as the greatest showman on earth, only for the boxing game. The New York Baseball Writers Association had its first annual banquet in January of 1924. Harry wrangled a ticket to there. He sees Tex Rickard and sits next to him down at the table and says, "Hey, Tex, I'm trying to get a pro football team together. You're a great promoter. You're willing to take on the big risk. How about it?" And Rickard says, "That's too big a risk for me." At that time, pro football was not a sure thing. So Rickard turned him down. Harry looks at a couple of other people, and finally he talks to a guy named Billy Gibson, who was also a boxing promoter, who managed Gene Tunney. Gene Tunney got really big. He was in the military, was boxing in World War I, and became a world champion after the war. So Harry contacts Billy Gibson, sets an appointment with him. This time he brings Joe Carr with him, mid-May, and they meet in Billy Gibson's office. Harry, Joe Carr, and Billy Gibson are in the office, and they're saying, "Here's the vision. We want football to be as big as Major League Baseball. We envision teams in all the big cities. It's going to be big as baseball, maybe even bigger." And Gibson had once been involved with pro football. 1921, he had sunk about $20,000 into a team sponsored by a guy named Charles Brickley, Charlie Brickley. Brickley had been a star for Harvard in the late teens, was known for his kicking prowess. And so Brickley had tried starting a team in 1921. He called them Brickley's Giants. That lasted less than a year, and Billy Gibson lost all his money. So Gibson just didn't want to do it, but he said, "What about my friend, Tim Mara?" So somehow Mara gets in this office. We don't know if he was invited or just happened to walk in. And so they're telling Harry and Joe Carr, are telling Tim Mara all about football. And Mara, he's a bookie. Being a bookie was legal in New York at that time. He's a sports promoter too. He had other businesses. He had a bookbindery. He had a coal field. Mara was a businessman. He knew what he was doing. But Mara said, "What's a franchise for this league cost?" Harry said, $500. Mara says, "A New York franchise for anything is worth $500. And he starts filling out a check. He hands the check over to Harry. He says, "Now that I've got a franchise, what do I do with it? I've never seen a football game." Harry just smiled and said, "You leave that to me." Mara hired Harry, and the New York Giants were born. That was May 1925. By September of that year, Harry had put together a team of collegiate all-stars led by Bob Falwell. Falwell had been a coach most recently with Navy. I think he'd been with Washington and Jefferson. He had always had successes. He was well known for his own athletic prowess. So he gets a top-name coach. He's recruiting top-name stars, including Dr. Joe Alexander of Syracuse, who was a credible lineman, Century Milstead, Gene Vidal, Lieutenant Gene Vidal, who had played for Army. And actually, he was an assistant football coach at Army when Harry's son Ken was at West Point. He's getting all these, Bob Nash, Bob Nasty Nash. He gets all these all-stars, well-known guys. He knows these big names are going to draw in fans. They're going to sell tickets, puts them together. And by September 1925, they have a meeting at the Alamac Hotel. It's a luncheon. He brings in all the newsies, and they announce the New York All-Collegians, better known as the Giants. And Harry says, "We're going to give them a good, clean, hard type of football that New Yorkers are going to enjoy." They release the schedule. It's a 16-game schedule. And the last two games, the last one in town, all the home games are going to be played at the Polo Grounds, are played with the Chicago Bears. That's great. Two big cities. So meanwhile, as Harry's building the Giants, he still needs a big name. He actually hires Jim Thorpe by 1925. Thorpe is really past his prime, but everybody knows him Thorpe had won gold medals in the Olympics. He had been a phenom in college ball with Carlisle and with the Canton Bulldogs of the teens into about 1920 or so. He was a big name draw, but he was not a good player anymore. Within a month of being with the Giants, Harry released Thorpe. It was a good thing. While it was never said, it is supposed that Thorpe was drinking at the time, and Harry did not tolerate drinking. His ads for his theatrical trips when he was trying to hire people, he said, if alcohol is part of your life, don't bother applying. He didn't want liquor to get in the way of people's work. So he let go of Jim Thorpe, the world's greatest athlete, but he had a great team and he had a great coach. So they begin their campaign. The first game was in Connecticut against New Britain, and I think they won. Next game, they played a home and away pair of games with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. Frankfurt is near Philadelphia, strong club team, and they get a big draw. But as the season is progressing, Harry's needing more money. He needs to sell tickets. He needs to print programs. He needs to sell advertising. Harry's getting his name in the paper, trying to promote the Giants. He's always in the newsrooms talking to reporters and news sportsmen. He's getting to know the local sportsmen and the national sportsmen as well. But the big draw in 1925 is Red Grange, Harold Red Grange of Illinois. I think in 24 it was, Grange made a national reputation for himself when he scored four touchdowns against Michigan in about 12 minutes. Amazing. His senior year, he was just as powerful, and he's starting to get offers for jobs everywhere, including from football teams. But the NFL prohibited its teams from signing college players. As long as they were in college, they couldn't sign them. But everybody knew Grange would be a draw. Rumors were going rampant that Grange was being recruited by some NFL teams, including the Giants. In newspaper articles, they were asking, sports writers were asking Harry about that. He says, nope, we cannot touch him. That's against the rules. Shortly after Grange's last game for Illinois, though, it gets made public. He is signing with the Bears. George Halas violated the league rules, or kind of went around it. Grange was no longer a college man because he dropped out. So technically, he did not violate the letter of the law, but he certainly violated the spirit of it. However, Grange was now playing for the Bears. The Bears were on the Giants' schedule for December 6th. It was going to be the last home game for the New York Giants. December 6th, 1925, the close of their inaugural year, the Giants are about $40,000 in the red. And yet all of New York is coming to see Red Grange play the New York Giants. Seating at the Polo Grounds is about 70,000. Before game day, over 60,000 tickets had been sold. On game day, people were lined up. They had to call an extra policeman to manage the traffic. Inside the ballpark, Harry's experience as a promoter was showing. The field was festooned with bunting hanging from all the seating of the red and white and blue of the Giants in the colors of the Bears. They were handing out big long feathers for all the fans to shake, just like pom-poms in the stands. Harry took one and stuck it in the band of his hat. And as one reporter said, he was wearing it Indian style. He was going up and down the sidelines. This was a big game. Just a couple of weeks before, Joe Carr, president of the NFL, had undergone emergency appendicitis surgery. Newspaper article said he's not going to make it. He's going to die. But by the time of this game, just a couple weeks later, after he had this emergency appendectomy, Joe Carr is attending this game because it's that big to the NFL. Red Grange in New York City is that big. He's on the sideline. He's on the bench with Harry and the team. So he's in attendance. 70,000 people. One reporter literally said some of the fans were up in the rafters. Grange did not play the whole game. As I recall, the Bears won 19. They scored 19, and I think the Giants scored about 7. So the Giants lost. People got to see Grange. I think he did score on an interception, ran it back for a touchdown. He had a pick six, and the fans went wild. But the big winner was Grange. He got a ton of money. His agent, C.C. Pyle, known as Cash and Carry Pyle, got a ton of money. but also the Giants. That one game put the Giants in the black for the year. So Tim Mara was willing to keep writing those checks that Harry needed, and took him on to the next season. Actually, the Giants traveled to Chicago for a follow-up game in Chicago, and they played there too. The inaugural season, it was successful. The Giants won 1-8. I think they're about 8-4-1 that season, so that's a pretty good start. The next season was not so good. They're still trying to find themselves. C.C. Pyle and Grange wanted to start their own NFL team. They were going to force their way into the NFL. So they appeared at the next NFL meeting in February 26. And they said, I've rented Yankee Stadium. I'm putting together a team. I'm coming in. Tim Mara says, oh, no, you don't. I've got exclusive rights to New York City. You can't do that. Some of the league owners wanted Grange to come in because they saw how much money he could bring in. But Mara said no. He stood up for his territorial rights, and finally he prevailed. So Grange and Pyle started their own rival league, and they tried building a league. It was very unsuccessful. The Giants lost money that year because the people didn't know which team to go see. And that folded in the next year. Grange came back to the Bears after that. By 1927, the Giants put together a championship team. Harry started from scratch in May of 1925. And in a couple of years, he built a championship team. He ended up becoming he was the secretary of the Giants, but he was also the team physician. He was the scout. He was the paymaster. He had the checkbook. He ran the Giants out of his apartment. Some of the Giants would stay in his apartment with him at 102nd and Broadway. In fact, the 1930 census actually shows Hap Moran living with him. And I think you spoke to Mike Moran a while back.
Yes, we did.
Mike Moran's a great guy, tremendous historian. And his dad was hired to play for the Giants by Harry, and he actually lived with Harry for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Steve Owen, who Harry hired, he convinced Tim Mara to hire Steve Owen, played for the Kansas City Cowboys at the time. Tough lineman, stout Steve, big, strong guy. They recruit Steve Owen actually buy his contract from Kansas City, and he starts playing for them. Within a year, he's captain of the team. In a couple of years, he's the coach. Steve Owens ends up being a Hall of Famer. And in his memoirs, he's talking about being in Harry's apartment and having a team meeting. The entire team is in Harry's apartment, and Harry's just sitting there off to the side. And he said one of the big features of Harry's apartment was his checkbook. And whenever these guys needed money, Harry was writing out another check. Steve Owen actually said, great in all ways were the things that Dr. March did for football in this city. By 1928, Harry is now the president of the New York Giants. Part of that's because he's been attending all the NFL league meetings as a representative of the Giants. Tim Mara steps back as president. He makes Harry the president because Tim Mara's got other things he's doing. He's still running his other business. He's still running his bookmaking business. For him, football is still a sideline. For Harry, it's his dream job. So Harry's the president of the Giants by 1929. He's on the NFL executive committee. He gets elected. He's working with guys like George Halas, Curly Lambeau, Dr. W. Kelly, who's from Green Bay, Peggy Parrott, who played for Case Western Reserve. He was played in some of the Ohio League teams. The executive committee is like the right-hand arm of Joe Carr, the president of the NFL. They make a lot of policy decisions. They help formulate policy. They determine whether or not things are within or with following policy or the rules. Harry regularly gets elected to the executive committee. As part of that, they would sometimes decide if there's a contract dispute between teams, who has the rights to a contract. By 1934, there's a dispute between the Giants and the Redskins, George Preston Marshall, about who owns the contract for Ed Donowski. It was referred to the executive committee, and the exec decided, no, the contract belongs to the Giants. Well, Marshall thought that was favoritism on Harry's part because Harry came up through the Giants. The very next team meeting in 1934, Marshall calls a special session of the league owners, proposes to eliminate the executive committee and start what they call a finance committee. The executive committee could be anybody elected from the floor, but the finance committee, you could only be a member if you had actual ownership of a team. Harry no longer owned any stock of the team. He had 5% of the Giants from the time, and I just learned this just last couple of weeks. I found a letter where Harry said that in a letter to George House. He had like $500 in it, and when he got bought out by Mara, he got $5,000 back. So he thought that was a pretty good investment.
Yeah, not bad at all. 10 times on your investment, right?
Yeah, and after about 5 or 6 years, but he certainly put a lot of time and effort into building the Giants. So anyway, George Preston Marshall is ticked off at the executive committee. Harry was the chairman of the executive committee, and the committee ruled against the Redskins that Donowski, his contract wouldn't go to the Redskins. So Marshall, in a power play, says, we're getting rid of the executive committee, which means he's getting rid of Harry. All the other members of the executive committee were actually owners of the teams. So this proposal had to get referred to the executive committee to see if it was in good order. So Harry had to rule on a motion to whether or not his job gets eliminated. And he said it was in order, and that vote was turned to the floor for action. It was unanimous except for one vote. John Mara, who replaced Harry as president with the Giants, voted against it. Harry was out of the NFL. But that year, he had begun writing a history of professional football. He had been there from the very beginning. In December 1933, the Literary Digest, a national magazine, wrote an article about the growing popularity of professional football. The football was still kind of a new thing, particularly pro football in the United States. Football in America, American football, was really just beginning to get popular at the end of the 19th century. Colleges had really started it. It didn't really become professionalized till shortly after that. Certainly not openly professionalized until the teens in the 1920s. So pro football was still a new thing. The Literary Digest is talking about the increasing popularity of professional football, and they interview Harry about this. And there's a picture of Harry in this article in the 1933 magazine. I've got a copy of it. It's a full-page article, and it says, Dr. Harry A. March, the father of professional football. And it talks about how Harry had been around pro football in his early days and how he helped start the Giants and how he'd been part of the NFL executive committee. And it talks about Tim Mara's role in there, too. One gets the impression that they interviewed two people to do this story, Harry and Tim Mara. Shortly after that article appeared, Harry starts writing letters saying, people are telling me I should write a history of pro football. So he writes a letter to Lud Ray of the Philadelphia Eagles, who had become his friend, looking for information about Lud Ray, about the Eagles, looking for photographs, and saying, I'm going to do this. This is important. You know, and other than me and Joe Carr, nobody else has been around long enough to really write the story. Who else is going to put in the time to do the research and find this out? So Harry starts writing letters, starts getting in touch with other team owners, looking for rosters, looking for records, looking for schedules, looking for photographs. And he gets photographs for his book. There's one photograph from Red Grange. He personalizes it and writes it to Harry. He says, to my friend, Dr. Harry A. March, a real sport and a straight shooter. There's team photos from the Bears sent to him by George Halas. Harry's using some of his recollections, but he's using his sources that he can. Within a year, he writes a book, 168 pages, 30 illustrations, scores of photographs, and the book is titled Pro Football, Its Ups and Downs. It is a huge hit. The league buys 100 copies on John Mara's recommendation to hand them out to promote football in general. That's the whole thing. It's promoting football. It's a nice little hardback book. You can also get it as paperback. I think hardback was a dollar and paperback 75 cents. Try getting one of those now for that price.
Yeah, right.
This book starts stamping Harry as the go-to guy for the knowledge of pro football. But before that, he had already gained that reputation. For years, sports reporters had contacted him, asked for their opinions of different athletes. In 1925 alone, one reporter asked Harry, who do you think are the top athletes in football today? He rated Grange seventh. And that was, oh my gosh, what are you doing? Grange, this is 1925. Now he starts talking about a player named Hinkie, Jim Thorpe, of course, a couple of others. And in this one article, they actually draw a cartoon likeness of Harry, quoting Dr. March. So he had a reputation for knowing football talent. That's what helped him build the Giants. And if you think about it later on, Wellington Mara, who is a Hall of Famer, took over from his brother John as owner and manager of the team. One of Wellington's top characteristics was being able to spot football talent. But if you read Wellington's biography, he's saying when he was, 10 years old, sitting on the bench with the Giants in 1925, he's getting to know, looking at football talent. He's watching Harry scouting. He's learning how to scout talent from Harry. Wellington never quotes that, but I'd like to think that Harry was a bit of an influence in that Hall of Famer's education. 1934, Harry writes the Pro Football, it's ups and downs. He gets kicked out of the NFL. And in that book, he's talking about starting a second league because he knows rivalry sells tickets. He knows from the Canton Maslin days, rivalry sells tickets. He knows in baseball, when you've got two teams, Dodgers and the Yankees, when they were both in New York. More recently, in my lifetime, Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. Though that isn't always a good game. Though Cincinnati won this year. We'll see what happens in the second game. Big Ben ain't what he used to be. Cleveland and Cincinnati. I mean, I grew up a Browns fan until Paul Brown brought a team here into Cincinnati. Rivalry builds fan interest. Fan interest sells tickets. Tickets brings profits. Harry understood that. So he started that second league, and he said, I don't care what school you went to. You just have to be tough enough to take it. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care what your race is. You just have to be talented and tough. He actually put together a recruiting brochure saying just that. He said, this is not an outlaw league. We're not going to try to steal talent away from the other league. We're going to rely on our ability to find the talent in those small schools. Steve Owen was from a small school. He wasn't getting all the ballyhoo of the guys from the Ivy Leagues. He was a talented football player. So Harry starts the American Professional Football League, 1936. And immediately the team owners, and he starts putting together, I think there's going to be eight teams in the league. Immediately they start recruiting NFL players. And Harry is saying no. And they're the money guys. Harry's the football guru, but he's not a money guy. And eventually it gets to the point where Harry can't stand it. And he resigns as president of the league he started. The league plays a season and it's gone within a year. So Harry's out of the NFL. He's out of his pro football league, but he's still considered the father of professional football. 1939, he publishes a second edition of his book with updated scores and team rosters. It was published just a few months after Joe Carr, his friend, had died. And there's one page there where he eulogizes Joe and saying, you know, if it weren't for you, pro football wouldn't be where it is today. And it says, you're my dear friend, and I know I'll be seeing you soon. Harry knows he hasn't got much time left on this earth. And within a year, Harry gets sick, and he goes home to Canton, where his dutiful wife, Edith, tends to him for the next few months, and Harry dies June 10th, 1940. Across the nation, newspapers report the death of the father of professional football. Now, later on, when George Halas dies, he's the father of professional football. And starting in 2015, fast forward, I decide to look into Harry and I start finding so much about him. Joe Carr was called the father of professional football about 1923. That's the earliest use of that term I'd ever seen. So why is Harry called the father of professional football? Well, if you open his book and you read the introduction by Grantland Rice, who was the guru of sports writers in the day, he's introducing this book. And he's saying why Harry is such an important guy. And at the bottom, the last line of his introduction is, Dr. March has been justly named the father of professional football. But why? Okay, he was team physician with the Canton Bulldogs, 1905-1906. He was not in Canton when Jack Cusack brought the Canton Bulldogs back, and when they became the powerhouse in the teens. He was in New York. He was running his theatrical troops. Really, Harry gets into pro football starting 1925 when he starts the Giants and becomes a member of the NFL's executive committee. My research at the archives at the Hall of Fame, wonderful place. If you need to do research, John Kendall there, he's their archivist. Great guy, very helpful. I find a newspaper article. Turns out, I think it's from the New York Herald. And it's at the end of the Giants season, like December 24th, I think, 1925. And there's a photo in the sports page. Harry sitting back. He's got a fedora on his head, jauntily tilted back. And it's telling Harry's story, how he talked to the postman, how he got inspired. I want to bring pro football to the big city. And how he went around trying to get Tex Rickard and all these other people involved and finally sold the franchise to Tim Mara. And the caption for that photograph is, the father of pro football in this city. Okay, I can see Harry is the father of pro football in New York City. I think Harry picked up that title and ran with it and started applying it to himself more generally, not just in this city, but I am the father of pro football. He even refers to himself in his book once. It says, when anybody's named the father of any endeavor, it's kind of an obligation to, and a difficult thing to do to live up to. But I think he has. Perhaps he was the nursemaid to pro football, if not the father. I certainly think he deserves recognition in the Hall of Fame, maybe not to be enshrined. But if you read the stories about what he did, he got football, pro football, started successfully in New York City. Charles Brickley, who had a bigger reputation, couldn't do it. He knew football. He found an angel in Tim Mara. Mara didn't know anything about football. He had never seen a football game. But Mara was a good businessman. More than that, he was willing to take a risk. He knew he could trust Harry to build a good team. And he wrote the checks and Harry spent the money. Harry promoted football. He promoted New York. He promoted the NFL. Harry had integrity. When it was brought to him that a motion that would kick him out of the league, he could have said, no, that's not in order. No, he said, okay, it's a proper motion. Let's go ahead and vote on it. He went ahead with it. When the league he started wanted to be that pirate league, he said, we're not going to be a pirate organization like that Pyle and Grange League in 1926. He stood up and he left his job. He brought integrity to it. A New Jersey article writing about Harry's death in 1940 talks about how Harry had brought integrity and respect to the pro game when in its early days, it was not a respected game. And they said, wouldn't it be nice if fans of the pro game would go to their local football stadiums and ballparks and ask the owners to put up a little plaque honoring Dr. March. So Harry brought integrity to the pro game. Certainly Joe Carr did too. Harry brought honorable pro football to New York City. And if it had not succeeded in New York City, the NFL might not have succeeded nationally. It started, it showed it could work in the big city. It showed it had to work. It used to be Green Bay. I mean, Green Bay is still a small town, but Dayton had a team. Akron had a team. Portsmouth, Ohio had a team. Buffalo had a team. Well, they've got a team now, too. But there's all sorts of small towns that had NFL teams. Providence, Rhode Island, Staten Island had its own team. But they all faded when they saw that the big city could successfully support a team. I think Harry's success with the Giants helped ensure the success of the National Football League. Harry's success with the Giants came from his ability to talk to reporters that he learned when he was a young man, his knowledge of logistics of moving football teams or theatrical troops, using railroads, using newspapers to promote, just making football an entertaining time for people. That's how he made the NFL successful.
Yeah, you know, I find it extremely interesting that I didn't realize that him and Joe Carr were such close friends. I knew they had a relationship going to approach Mr. Mara. But we've had Chris Willis on. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work.
Yes.
He wrote a book on Red Grange. He wrote one on Joe Carr, wrote one on the Panhandles. And when we had him on just a couple weeks ago talking about Joe Carr's birthday. Actually, it's going to be out this week, the Saturday, the 23rd. And he described Joe Carr much in the same way that you described Harry. You know, in their early life, they were very organized. They brought those organizational skills and things that they learned, and they helped develop teams that they were involved with, you know, a car with the Panhandles and, you know, what you're saying with Harry with the Giants. And so I can see why they were friends, both Ohio guys and very similar paths. And I think it's quite an honor for them, for Harry, for Joe Carr, for George Halas, and probably a couple other people to all be considered the fathers of pro football, because I think it took that village of those gentlemen to have the foresight to know that pro football was going to be big someday and be as big as baseball, be as big as college football, because it wasn't at that time. It was, a much smaller case that most people didn't think was going to survive or be much of anything. But just to have the visionaries that those men, including Harry, had, I think is vital to what made the NFL what it is today. So thank you for sharing that with us.
My father, who was named for Harry, worked for Kenner Toys 1963 to 1976. And I knew him as the father of the Easy Bake Oven. I knew my dad had invented the Easy Bake Oven.
Really?
And yes. And wow. When a fellow Kenner engineer died, 2009, I guess, that guy's obituary said he had invented the Easy Bake Oven. And I asked my dad, what is it about this? And he explained to me what happened, that they were both part of it. And I said, so what's going on here? He said, success has many fathers. Failure is an orphan. So if the NFL had failed, maybe we would never know Joe Carr's name. But if the NFL had failed, maybe we wouldn't know Harry's name. But success has many fathers. So, like you said, it takes that village. I think one reason Harry's name is not known is because he was not a money man. He was never good with money. That's why I had to work for a living. even though he'd been part of the Giants from the day one. But he was okay with that. He enjoyed life. His epitaph on his headstone, if I can read it to you. Certainly. His headstone is in the Westlawn Cemetery in Canton, Ohio. It says, Harry A. March, 1875 to 1940, physician, author, soldier, statesman, quote, learn to laugh and do not worry. That was his philosophy of life. Now, when I started on this journey of learning about Harry, I went to visit his headstone. I thought, where did that come from? Learn to laugh and do not worry. About a year ago, I found a collection of some of Harry's papers. In it was his calling card. And the calling card's a little 3x5 card, and it says RX in the upper left-hand corner. So it's like a prescription. Contentment Brew 100%. And there's a little free verse. It says, happiness is the halfway stop between too much and too little. Linger long. Laughter snatches crumbs from poor doctor's lips, but he doesn't object and is glad. Learn to laugh and do not worry. Dr. Harry A. March. So that was his philosophy of life. Don't sweat the details. Learn to laugh. Don't worry. He wasn't concerned about money. He was concerned about doing the right thing the right way for the right reason.
He might have been the author of that famous song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Maybe that was in that song. You know, that's like, yeah.
When I started really looking into his life, looking for photographs, I love photographs, and he started appearing in group photographs, unnamed. Here he is in this group shot. I mean, there's all these different guys. There's Joe Carr. There's Harry. There's Jim Thorpe. There's Harry. There's 300 U.S. Army, Belgian Army, French Army, English Army physicians at camp in Camp Greenleaf in 1918. It's a big panoramic photograph at Library of Congress. There's Harry taking a knee in the front row, just like he was with the 1906 Canton Bulldogs. He's like Forrest Gump. He's touched so much of American history, and I think he's had an impact on it, but nobody knows his name.
Well, it's a truly spectacular story, and I know that you're working on a book. I hope that you can get that going and get that completed, because that would truly be a treasure to have for Dr. Harry March, especially from his legacy of you know, his great-grandson. And we thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
You were saying, Alan, that there was a museum in Ohio where you're telling Dr. March's story also. Maybe if you have that, the ad.
Yeah, that's the Ohio address? History Connection in Columbus. Okay. It's the Ohio History Center. It's a big gray box real close to the Matt Frey Soccer Stadium, and the Ohio History Connection was a couple of years ago was putting together an exhibition called Ohio Champion of Sport. And it talks about how all the great sports, pro football, professional baseball, have their roots right here in Ohio. And as part of that, the person designing the exhibition contacted me. She'd heard about Harry and wanted to learn a little bit about him. So I sat down at the History Center and gave him a couple hours of yakking. As you can tell, I like to talk. And they've got some video snippets throughout the exhibition. It's on two floors. It's got artifacts. It's got photographs. It's got stories from soapbox derby to women's professional wrestling and boxing and skiing, football, baseball. It's amazing how important Ohio is to sports in this country. And some of these little snippets of oral history appear in kiosks throughout. And actually, in one of them is a copy of the 1939 edition of Harry's book. It's from my collection. I loaned it to them. And it shows the 1939 edition of Pro Football, its ups and downs. Try finding one online today. They're there, but they're expensive.
Yeah, like you said, you won't get it for $1.75 like it was back in the day, right?
Yeah.
Well, Alan, I appreciate your sharing Harry's story, and thank you for your time. And that's an excellent story, and definitely a person that should be remembered for football history, because he's a very important person, and we appreciate you coming on and talking about him.
You're welcome.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One shop, check out the thousands more of unique unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long-sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items, plus get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.